Hello and welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 19th of March 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live today at RadioAlbion.com because we have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, Communism by the Back Door and the Freemasonic Victors of World War II and the soon-to-be-finished Churchill's Body Count, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, hello, sir.
Hello, sir. Yeah, caught me on the up this week an hour earlier.
Yes, caught me out as well. It caught me out earlier this week and today. I went off to have me dinner when the Daily Nationalist came on and it was only 4 o'clock, so I had to come back to the computer for another hour. Catches me out every time.
It's amazing how it upsets everything, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you would think that America and Britain, they would get these things synchronized. So the American clocks changed at the same times as the British clocks. But no, they have to do it a different way around. And I'm sure it must catch out other content producers as well and live streamers. That's just the way it goes. Yes, I'm still here, Dennis.
Yes, you went off for a second then.
Oh, I don't know what happened there. Yeah, I'm still here. We're still here. Listeners are
cool.
Listeners are still there. We'll just give a little advert for Greatest Story Never Told. That is still for sale. You can purchase the DVD of that from moneytreepublishing.com. There's a link to it at the Radio Albion site in the sidebar there where you see the Truthful Out Films link. Just click that and that will take you to Dave Gahari's site. There's also Hellstorm on there as well and some other books and videos. And what you want to be looking for on there is Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told. The best documentary ever made on World War II. Dennis, have you? Do you know if the DVDs are selling well at all?
Yeah, they're selling really well. Yeah, I'm also playing around with a PDF of the, you know, of the Greatest Story Never Told as well. Just in my spare time, just, you know, maybe a couple of pages a day, which is coming along.
Well, that's handy. So it would be like a script for it.
Yeah.
Would that be possible to use that for a deaf version, do you think?
I would imagine so, yeah. Yeah, especially if the guy can read.
Yeah, I mean, that would be very helpful, wouldn't it? If we could get a version out there for deaf people so that they could have a look at it as well. And how is Churchill's Body Count coming along?
Well, the problem with the Churchill's Body Count is a software where I've got at the moment. I have to master that yet before I can attempt it, and it's I may even have to use fresh software yet. Depends how it goes. I haven't decided yet, but that is the problem at the moment.
Well, you use Apple, don't you, instead of Windows?
I do use Apple, yeah.
You're still using Apple then, are you?
Yeah.
You seem to like Apple. I really don't like them. I prefer to stick with Windows. I can never find the settings on Apple computers. Have all sorts of problems trying to work with people with Apple. But I know you swear by them, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, a class Windows compared to Apple as a toy, to be honest, but each to their own, really.
Yeah, well, you've certainly managed to make some excellent documentaries using their software. Well, this week we thought what we'd have a look at is Jewish emigration during the Third Reich, because there is this narrative that that the Jews were somehow trying to escape from Germany and the Germans were not letting them get out and they were putting them in camps and persecuting them. And there's a real hidden story to this. And you talked about it a little bit in Greatest Story Never Told, didn't you, Dennis, about the Havara agreement?
Well, that's the first time I came across it. And it really kept really under wraps for a long time, because it was Edwin Black, who was a Jew himself, who first wrote the book, The Transfer Agreement, and his parents disowned him. They wouldn't speak to him. And that was during the 80s, until I came along and did The Greatest Story Never Told and came across this information. I certainly hadn't heard of it.
Well, there's even more than that. There was another agreement as well where they were going out around the world. They had the help from different Jewish groups. Eventually, the Mossad was formed to actually help them as well. And the Third Reich worked alongside them. because the Germans realised that this was a good thing, actually, and that Jews should be encouraged to identify as Jews and to identify together and to build their own country over in Palestine. And there's a lot more to this story that I didn't actually know about. And I found a book by Ingrid Weckert, which is called Jewish Immigration in the Third Reich. And I've read another leaflet of hers, which was to do with Kristallnacht, which was really good. I think I did a narration on her book on Kristallnacht. And I discovered this book the other day, and I thought we could use this as a basis for our notes and have a bit of a discussion about it, because there's a lot in this that I don't think our listeners will be aware of. I certainly wasn't aware of. Anyway, so I'll begin with the introduction here, and she explains why she wrote this book. She says, "Current historical writings dealing with matters related to the Third Reich paint a bleak picture, but such historiography has nothing to do with the depiction of actual historical events. This applies especially to writings that deal with the Jewish ethnic group, and the emigration of Jews from Germany is an example of such historical distortion. To this day, there are still accounts of the Jewish emigration that depict it as some kind of clandestine operation, as if the Jews who wished to leave Germany had to sneak over the borders in defiance of the German authorities, leaving all their possessions and wealth behind, or as if certain routes out of Germany were insider knowledge, not available to all Jews. In other accounts, the emphasis is on Germany offering exit visas for a high price. There is no limit either to the inventive powers or to the stupidity of their authors. The truth is that the emigration was welcomed by the German authorities and frequently occurred under a constantly increasing pressure. The anti-Semitic legislation of the Third Reich is an undisputed fact in this emigration story. Likewise, the psychological pressure that Jews in Germany came to experience after 1933 will not be trivialised here. It was often tragic for individuals and families. But this tragedy has already entered the public consciousness through countless publications in radio and television programmes, so we needn't recapitulate it here. However, counter to numerous eyewitness or autobiographical accounts, the following needs to be insisted upon. Emigration was not some kind of wild flight, but rather a lawfully determined and regulated matter. The purpose of this work is to elucidate the emigration process in law and policy, thereby augmenting the traditionally received picture of Jewish emigration from Germany. German and Jewish authorities worked closely together on this emigration. Jews interested in emigrating received detailed advice and offers of help from both sides. The accounts of Jews fleeing Germany in secret by night across the border are untenable. On the contrary, the German government was interested in getting rid of its Jews. It would have been senseless to prevent such an emigration." And that just seems like common sense, doesn't it? Because we know that the Germans weren't happy with the Jews. They wanted to have an ethnostate without Jews there. And the best way to do that was to encourage them to emigrate somewhere else. And yet we're sort of told today that that didn't happen, and they just put them in camps and they wanted to exterminate them. And this story really tells us that really they wanted what was best for the Jews as well as what was best for the Germans. There wasn't any maliciousness to this, I don't
no,
think.
No, the problem is that since all this has come to light again, it's been twisted, where people have used it now to say that that Hitler was working with the Zionists all along, when, as you just said then, it was in the Germans' interest, as well as the Jewish interest, because they wanted rid of them, and obviously the Jews, maybe not all at the same time, wanted their own homeland. So it was all a peaceful alternative. Plus, you've got to remember, nobody else wanted to take them anyway, not even Britain or the US.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it? Because Germany did work with the Zionists, because the Zionists wanted all the Jews of the world to come and move to Palestine. And, that coincides with the National Socialist policies, doesn't it? And at the time...
Yeah, certainly, yeah.
at the time, it wasn't international Zionism. It wasn't like it is today when we think of Zionism and we think of our politicians, and that they appear to have more loyalty to Israel than they do to our countries, and our militaries go off and fight wars, which to a lot of people seems to be as if they're just fighting these wars for the benefit of Israel. None of that was happening at this time. What you had this nationalist movement, which was about a national identity for Jews, and encouraging that and saying, let's get all the Jews together into this ethno-state. And it was a similar idea to National Socialism. Let's get all the Germans together within a German ethno-state. And as we'll hear at the start, there really wasn't this animosity between the Germans and the Jews as we think. But because of this link, as you were pointing out there, Dennis, because there was this working with the Zionists, and because of the way Zionism is viewed today, people would try and use this to run the National Socialists down and say that it was all a secret Jewish plan all along, which is obviously nonsense. Yeah. Right, we'll start.
Don't forget, of course, that, you know, the fact that some Germans were aware of the Jews being in, you know, the powers on the stage or in political arena, you know, the media, and on the other side of the coin, they were frightened of Bolshevism, which they thought to be, you know, a Jewish threat. So there was a bit of a fear in Germany from you know, the Jews itself.
Also, Zionism was a fairly small movement, wasn't it? It was nowhere near as big as communism and the communist movement.
No, communism was the big one, wasn't it?
Yeah, the number of Jews that were involved in Zionism was really dwarfed by the number of Jews that were involved in communism and Bolshevism.
Yeah, and they tried to take Germany over, remember?
Yeah, the communists did.
Yeah.
The communists did, and a large portion of them were Jewish, which is obviously going to cause there to be ructions between the two peoples, yeah. Just to put it bluntly. Well, we'll start with Chapter 1, the Jewish Declaration of War. After Adolf Hitler was elected Reich Chancellor on January the 30th, 1933, and the subsequent assumption of power by the National Socialist Party, the majority of Germany's 500,000 Jews did not anticipate any significant change in their situation. At the most, they expected temporary hindrances in one area or the other, but not exclusion from public life, let alone expulsion from Germany. Thus, only politically motivated individuals packed their bags and resettled in a foreign country, most of them believing that sooner or later they would return to Germany. So I'll just stop here and I'll say that this book is meticulously footnoted. It has all the references there. It tells you where all the original documents come from to suggest this, that the Jews didn't have any fear at this time. And secondly, this was at the time when Jews, such as the ones that were involved in the Frankfurt School, when they were moving, and Albert Einstein, the subversive types, the Marxist types that knew that it was nationalists. Yeah. Taken over, and they were moving not because they were Jews, but because they had been promoting degeneracy and Marxism. And what was the name of that sex doctor that was there?
Oh, Herschel, was it? No,
Herschel or Hirschfeld,
something like that. Yeah, it was Hirschfeld. Very prominent in Berlin,
and his sex institute, and Wilhelm Reich, and all these other ones that E. Michael Jones talks about. They were the sort of people that left. The other Jews that were there, they weren't really expecting much to happen at all. And a lot of them had become very Germanified, which we'll see later on. Well, on March the 24th, 1933, just 2 months after the National Socialists took power, World Jewry, as it referred to itself, declared war on Germany. As World Jewry did not have its own state, it used the power at its disposal, namely its influence on the world economy, to impose a worldwide boycott of Germany. After this spectacular declaration, which appeared in the London Daily Express, it should have been obvious to World Jewry and also to Jews living in Germany that there would be consequences. No country in the world with any self-respect, and Germany at that time regarded itself quite favourably, can ignore such a challenge. And in fact, the boycott hit Germany at its weakest point. Now, it should be said here that the the people that were behind this group calling themselves World Jewry, they were based in America, and they quite clearly had no concern at all for what was going to happen to the Jews that were in Germany, the ones who were looking forward to not having a violent Bolshevik takeover, but were looking forward to the country being regenerated. And suddenly they're being linked with this group that is declaring war against Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to add any points to that, Dennis?
Yeah, well, you've got to remember there's 80 million Germans at the time, including the Jews. And when the war was declared, it was supposedly declared on the Nazi government or the Nazis, which probably amounted to nowhere near 80 million. So all the country, including the Jews, were going to be suffering, even those who supported or didn't like National Socialism.
Well, they declared war. Judea declares war on Germany was the headline. It wasn't Judea declares war on the National Socialists. It was on Germany. And you got all these Jews that actually live in Germany, and the rest of World Jewry, the rest of their kinsmen, have just effectively outed them all as traitors, which was, you know, not very good for the Jews that were living in Germany.
Well, there's going to be a backlash, that's the thing.
Yeah.
Even though, I mean, I consider Crystal Night just a short period, you know, compared to many revolutions. Crystal Night was quickly stopped by Goebbels and Hitler because they were in negotiations to try and end this blockade, which, you know, again, I show in The Greatest Story Never Told.
Well, the last thing they would have done would have been to, you know, start attacking the Jews that were there. But that would have made the situation worse because they needed this economic blockade to be lifted. So they did. They actually put protections in place because the average German was obviously very upset at this and would have wanted to take it out on the Jews that were in Germany. But the administration certainly didn't want that because they didn't want to be seen to be persecuting the Jews at all. And they gave Jews extra special protections. I mean, one of the reasons when they were actually wearing that badge was so that, you know, if they called for the police would come there straight away because they knew that they were liable to be a target and that identified them. So they would be protected. You know, there were protective reasons for why they were encouraged to actually wear those badges. But we'll hear more detail as we go along here about the way that the Germans actually protected them and why. But the economic situation was absolutely catastrophic. There were over 6 million unemployed, countless bankrupt enterprises, and a collapsed economic system, which posed for the new German government an almost insurmountable burden and a seemingly insolvable task. And on top of that, the foreign boycott of its goods should have dealt Germany a death blow. That it did not, that on the contrary, Germany's economy recovered with astounding rapidity, thereby setting an example for other countries, was due entirely to the genius of its leadership. This is confirmed not only by contemporary reports, but also by recent studies devoted to presenting these facts. Of these, the two chapters devoted to Germany's economic recovery in Rainer Zitelmann's Hitler are most instructive. And this was at the time when Time magazine made Hitler the man of the year, wasn't it, for what he did with the economy?
Yeah, that's going to surprise a lot of people. Yeah, certainly.
This economic miracle that they managed to succeed in pulling off, it wasn't just that they had all these unemployed and all these problems, but they also had this boycott on all their goods. And they were also unable to use foreign currency either. They'd been frozen out by the banks and they'd been frozen out with this boycott of goods. And it really looked like there was no way that they were actually going to manage to bounce back. But they did bounce back. And I'll tell you how they bounced back. Hitler began a national credit program by devising a plan of public works that included flood control, repair of public buildings and private residences, and construction of new roads, bridges, canals, and port facilities. And all these were paid for with money that no longer came from the private international bankers. The projected cost of these various programs was fixed at 1 billion units of the national currency. And to pay for this, the German government, not the international bankers, issued bills of exchange called Labour Treasury Certificates. In this way, the National Socialists put millions of people back to work and paid them with these Treasury Certificates. And under the National Socialists, Germany's money was not backed by gold, which was owned by the international bankers. It was essentially a receipt for labour and materials that had been delivered to the government. And Hitler said that for every mark issued, we required the equivalent of a mark's worth of work done or a mark's worth of goods produced. And the government paid the workers in these certificates, and workers would then spend those certificates on other goods and services, thus creating more jobs for more people. And in this way, the German people managed to climb out of the crushing debt that was imposed upon them by the international bankers. They even managed to restore foreign trade, despite the international bankers' denial of foreign credit to Germany, and despite the global boycott by Jewish-owned industries. Germany succeeded in doing this by exchanging equipment and commodities directly with other countries using a barter system that cut the bankers out of the picture. And apparently Venezuela does a similar thing now. They use a barter system with their oil, because countries like Venezuela cannot actually sell their oil, and countries like Iran, they can't sell their oil for dollars, the international unit of currency, and they end up having to do like an exchange system sort of thing. And this is what Germany did to actually get around this. So instead of actually being strangled to death by the boycott and by the restrictions placed on the foreign currency, it meant that they actually did everything for themselves, and they bounced back while the rest of the world was in a depression in that time.
I think obviously, you know, many people are saying that we're heading for a cashless society. And I think that's when the barter system will come into this country as well. So when people, who can't usually work for cash, or, you know, certainly cashing out on jobs which they don't really want to be paying tax on, if that's abolished and it's just a credit card, everything's going to be checked and numbered. The barter system, it will be one way around it.
Well, it would have to be. The problem with, if they do away with cash now, is it will be like the Chinese social credit system. And if you're politically incorrect, then what they will do is you won't be able to engage in business transactions. At least in China, they do it for positive things. I mean, if you're not pro-China, then you could fall foul of this social credit system. But our countries are anti-white, and it would be if you're pro-white, you actually lose your credit. So the Germans did an amazing thing to actually fight back against this. And it was world Jewry that was the first to actually declare war. Obviously, it was Britain later on, once it actually became a military war. But they managed to work their way around this boycott. But it can't be overestimated just how much this boycott must have affected them and upset them. You know, it's like kicking somebody when he's down. And they'd only been in office for 2 months. And then, they have to deal with this. Well, one of the consequences that flowed from the antagonistic attitude of so-called world Jewry was the German government's endeavour to remove its Jewish citizens, to encourage them to emigrate. And for the German Jews, this was a tragic development, as regardless of the fact that world Jewry had declared war on Germany, for hundreds of thousands of them, Germany was their home, and most of them had actually lived in Germany for generations. At first, emigration was not a feasible alternative, and for a long time, many could not take that decisive step. So what they're saying here, it was actually this boycott that actually led to Germany saying, well, we don't want these Jews here anymore then. If you're going to declare war on us and tell us that these Jews that we've got in our country are now our enemies, obviously we don't want our enemies living within our country. So that was the result of this. So it wasn't that the National Socialists automatically wanted to get rid of the Jews. It was the fact that the Jews had declared war on them. So, I mean, it really did put the Germany's Jews into an impossible situation, I think.
Yeah, some Jews obviously thought themselves more German as well. So they were interested in going to Palestine.
Well, a lot of them did, I think. I mean, we'll see as we come across this. We had some Jewish organisations at the time. Among the German Jews, there were numerous groups and subgroups representing a multitude of differing political opinions. Besides the purely religious organisations, there flourished some very diverse associations, often with opposing viewpoints on various questions. The four largest Jewish organisations were the Central Union of German Citizens of Jewish Faith, the CV, which was formed in 1893. Later, the organisation was renamed the Central Union of Jews in Germany, and the membership numbered about 10,000, and its political voice was the CV Zeitung. There was also the Zionist Union of Germany, the ZVFD, founded in 1897, with up to 10,000 members. It published the Jüdische Rundschau, the Jewish Review. In 1925, this Zionist Union split and the new Zionist movement arose. They also called themselves the Revisionists, or the State Zionists. The name State Zionists indicated their desire for a Jewish state. The founder and leader of the Revisionists was Vladimir Jabotinsky, and his deputy in Germany was George Koreski. The Reich Federation of Jewish Soldiers was another organisation, which was founded in 1919 and had about 10,000 members. It published a newspaper called Der Schild. So that's something a lot of people don't get and don't understand. There were Jewish soldiers that were fighting on the side of Germany. When you think of Jews, you think mainly of bankers, don't you? You don't really think of military men. But they had just as many in the Reich Federation of Jewish Soldiers as they did in the Zionist movement. 10,000.
Yeah, members. again, covered in the great story. Yeah, there's about 150,000 Jews fought for Hitler and many. And you won medals of bravery.
150,000 in all, you say?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that gives you an idea, because that's about a third, well, it's just under a third of the total number of Jews in Germany. So just under a third of them actually fought for the Germans.
Yeah.
So it wasn't those ones that they were encouraging to move then. The Union of National German Jews, the VNJ, was founded in 1921. That had about 10,000 members. Its newspaper was the National Deutsche Jude, the National German Jew. In order to represent Jewish interests more effectively, an umbrella organisation was formed, the Reich Deputies of German Jews. That's like the British Deputies of Jews, isn't it? The British Board of Deputies, that's what they have in Britain. For the Jews. In 1939, it changed its name to the Reich Association of Jews in Germany. The VNJ, however, refused to join this umbrella organisation. In spite of these differences, two basic directions emerged. One in which Germanism was the top priority and Judaism was a religious matter, and the other in which a consciousness of belonging to a separate Jewish nation was combined with the Jewish religion. The second of these two groups comprised the Zionists, who were a minority among the German Jews, but in time became the most influential force. I think they became the most influential force because, you know, the whole idea of National Socialism was nationalism. It was about realizing your ethnic identity, associating with your ethnic identity, advocating for them. And obviously, you know, the Jews would have been thinking about that as well. And thinking, well, we should be doing this. And the Germans would have encouraged them as well. So Zionism actually took over from this idea of the Jews being just like the Germans. And that had only been going on for 100 years. 1812 it was when they had when the Jews were emancipated in Germany. And they were basically given civil rights and given all the same rights as Christians. But they'd only had that for 100 years. Up until that point, they'd understood themselves as to be separate and to be different as Jews. But from 1812 onwards, they were encouraged to think of themselves as Germans and to speak German. And now what's happening is it's going back to how it was beforehand. And they're saying, well, it would be better for you to think of yourselves as Jews, and we'll encourage you in that. And I don't have anything against Israel, because it's a nationalist endeavor. You know, I don't like the idea of international Zionism. And our country's having too much loyalty to Israel. But as the idea of a homeland the Jews to have, where they can be Jews and enact their Jewish laws and all the rest of it. You know, I can't fault that. I support that idea. It'd be wrong of me to not support that, because I support that for myself. What are your views on Israel as a state, Dennis?
Well, I think the problem with Israel is that over the years, there's been certain blackouts of news of what's happening down in Palestine, where more or less it's a concentration camp. You know, the US Liberty, that's been a blackout as well. So there's certain things that Israel has done since coming to be a country that I'm not being particularly happy with.
So you've got issues with the way they've treated other people, but not an issue with them.
Well, financial issues as well, because we pay a hell of a lot down to Israel and America as well. I covered that in Communism by the Back Door, where, you know, there's parts of America where, you know, some pensioners are suffering, and yet they send billions down to Israel. And even then, they're given the priority of receiving it at a certain time of the year, where Israel don't pay interest on the money, but the American people then have to pay the interest on the money. So it's a double whammy.
Well, that's an issue with America, though, isn't it? That comes under the heading of other countries being more loyal to Israel than they are to their own. And that's an issue with America. That's an issue with Britain. But the actual idea of the Jews having their own country, you know, I don't have a problem with that at all.
Well, no, I don't have a problem with that myself. It's just that the practice that Israel sometimes gets up to is not applicable to my way of thinking.
They're a different people, so they have different standards to us. So, you know, that's the way that I look at it. They have a different way of doing things, and that's why they are a different people. We should think of them as a different people. And that's the way that the National Socialists were looking at them, as, you know, this is a different people with different ways to us. And that was a different way of treating the Jews than they had been treated for the last 100 years. The majority of Germany's Jews had been settled there for over a century. The Jewish Edict of 1812 eliminated all legal restrictions on them and gave Jews the same political rights as other Germans. They thus saw themselves as Germans and not as aliens. In the first few years after 1933, this attachment to Germany led not only to declarations of support for their German fatherland and the National Socialist movement, but also to open antagonism towards the Zionists, who pressed for emigration with growing fervour. At first, even the Zionist Jüdische Rundschau newspaper of April 13, 1933, declared, "The German people must know that the historical ties of centuries cannot simply be severed." A little later, on August the 29th, 1933, the same newspaper wrote, "We believe that the German Jews must find their place and their integration in this state, and we hope that it will occur in harmony with the basic principles of the new state." Even after the Nuremberg Laws on September the 9th, 1935, the Jüdische Rundschau wrote that it was now the task of Jews to develop their special status within the German people in a positive way. And we'll hear later on, actually, how the Jews were actually quite pleased with the Nuremberg Laws, because they didn't want Jews to be marrying non-Jews just as much as the Germans didn't want Germans to be marrying non-Germans. What do you think of what they're saying here, Dennis, about Jews?
Well, I'm thinking that anybody who's new to all this information will find it hardly, you know, a shock to the system.
Oh, there's a lot here.
It's completely opposite to what we've been taught.
Yeah, there's a lot here that I was unaware of, but it does all check out. And she's a well-known researcher, Ingrid Weckart. Mm. Several quotations that document how closely Jewish citizens identified with Germany in those years follow below. This is not to suggest that the majority of Jews did not adopt an attitude of distrust or rejection of the National Socialist government, but there were other points of view as well that are generally suppressed today. The first article of the Constitution of the Union of National German Jews states, "The Union of National German Jews is an organization of Germans of Jewish ancestry who publicly declare that they feel their heritage is the German spirit and the German culture, so that they can only feel and think as Germans." And again, I'll just stop there. And you have to ask yourself, well, was that because, you know, of the pressure of the National Socialists, and they're trying to say, well, we're just as German as you, because I don't think it could have been, because the whole thing about National Socialism was that it was racial, and the National Socialists would have been encouraging the Jews to think of themselves as Jews and not to think of themselves as Germans. This was actually going against the National Socialist ideas. So it's interesting to think about the motivations behind them.
Yeah.
At the time when they're saying this. And there was a doctor, Dr. Max Naumann, who was the chairman of the VNJ, had published numerous essays about the Jewish question a decade earlier in 1920 and 1924, which is long before the rise of National Socialism. And he took the following position in these writings. He differentiates between German Jews and foreign Jews, stating, "The German Jews belong to the German people. The foreign Jews, scattered to the winds, are a people without a country. Even the English Palestine is not their country and never will be their country." He defines the foreign Jews as a group marked by the fanatical attachment to backwardness through the madness of being a community of the chosen and a problem for others. He considers the Zionists to be among the foreign Jews. Here again, he chooses between two groups. The honest and upright thinking Zionists are those who recognize their difference and are prepared to live in Germany as foreigners, if need be, under legal constraints as aliens. But those who neither belong to the German Jews nor to the conscious Zionists are the remainder that deserves to perish. It is better that a few rootless perish than that hundreds of thousands of people who know where they belong perish. Our German people must not perish, he says here. It is possible to claim that this was one man's opinion, but Dr. Naumann was re-elected the chairman of the Union of National German Jews year after year. That would not have been possible had the union sought to distance itself from Dr. Naumann's views. So it is fair to assume that there was a group of Jews who shared this extreme view of their Jewishness. As noted above, the Union of National German Jews refused to join the organisation that comprised the other major Jewish groups. Its members felt so German that they saw no need to join a Jewish umbrella organisation. Even more radical was the attitude of a German national youth group, the Black Banner. It dissolved itself in 1934 after a number of its members left Judaism in order, as the official declaration states, to demonstrate complete separation from Judaism in every form. And again, we have to think this is not what the National Socialists were promoting. You know, they were encouraging them to see themselves as Jews. And these Jews are saying, we don't want to be Jews, we want to be Germans like you. It's it must be quite flattering for the Germans.
Well, yeah, I'm sure. I mean, there were some Germans close to it, some Jews close to Hitler who were, you know, classed as German eventually.
Well, yeah, it's not black and white, is it? It's not.
No, no.
You know, it's not simple. There were, what was the name? It's not Ernst Röhm, was it? What was the name of that Jew that was very close to Hitler?
Well, the chauffeur. There we got me. Off the top of my head. But Schoffer was also started the SS, Morris.
There was actually somebody or other. There was actually a Jewish SS.
Yeah, I believe so, yeah.
Which and, we were to.
Well, when it was recognised that he had Jewish descent, Hitler didn't have a problem with it.
Well, you can understand why. When you've got people here that are very, very keen to identify with the Germans, and they don't want the trouble that other Jews have caused. So they're talking about German culture. They're saying, we feel at home here. We've been here for a long time. We support you. You know, as you pointed out, 150,000 of these Jews fought on the side of the Germans, and that must have been very flattering for the German people. So you can see that them saying, well, yeah, we can have you. And as they say here, they said even as aliens or as guests, because what they did in law, that you had German citizens who had the right to take part in politics and decide the laws and the democracy and all the rest of it. And then you had guests, and guests were entitled to be protected by the law, the same as anybody. But where they were guests, they weren't allowed to be politicians. They weren't allowed to be teachers in schools. and they weren't allowed to have a say in how the country was run. But they were quite welcome to stay there if they, you know, if they weren't against the country.
That's right. Yeah, I just found the name. It was Emil Morris. He was a personal friend of Hitler, one-time chauffeur bodyguard, and he was also one of the founding members of the SS. So he had Jewish descent, but wasn't a problem to Hitler.
Well, that's, you know, that's just one example. You know, there were quite a few. You know, this idea that they just wanted to exterminate all the Jews, you know, that's just, it's just not right.
No, that's propaganda, isn't it? Just to get the hatred, or keep the hatred going.
These national German Jews expressed a number of positive opinions on Germanism and National Socialism as well. In 1931, the magazine Der National Deutsche Jude posed the question, can Jews be National Socialists? And the answer was a unanimous yes. In its January 1931 issue, the magazine wrote, did not we Jews shed our blood on the battlefields for Germany? Was not a Jew the president of the first German parliament in the Paulskirche? Was not the founder of the Conservative Party a Jew? Whom do the parties thank for having adopted the rallying cry for a united fatherland, their creation and their organisation? The Jews. Who was the first, precisely and clearly, to formulate the demands that today are the main points of the National Socialist programme? A Jew. Walter Rathenau. I mean, that's quite surprising, isn't it?
It is. I've just found the details on the 150,000 soldiers who had Jewish blood and eventually fought for the Third Reich. It included 2 field marshals, 15 generals, 8 lieutenant generals and 5 major generals. Together they commanded up to 100,000 troops.
Very different to what we're taught. In May 1933, after Hitler assumed power, the same magazine wrote in a special edition, and this is the magazine Der National Deutsche Jew, the National German Jew, the Germany of the future is faced with completely new tasks, which can only be solved by a nation renewed at its foundation. To create this nation in the form of a national community that has never before existed in Germany's history is the major and, if properly undertaken, truly liberating task of the national leader. So they're sort of seeing themselves as, you know, as being separate, but still being there as part of the nation. They weren't against National Socialism. And I don't think, if it hadn't been for the interference of, you know, the group calling itself World Jewry, you know, things could have turned out very different, I think.
Yeah, the problem was communism, because a lot of the communists were Jews. And so they were classed as enemy of the state. Obviously, they tried to overtake Germany at one point. And so when Hitler came to power, these communists were putting camps, you know, for hard labour. And obviously being a few Jews in there, that caused a reaction or an excuse for the Jews outside of Germany to build this this myth of what most people today believe.
Well, yeah, they try to say that, oh, they were only in the camps because they were Jews and it was all Jews. No, they were communists that were put in the camps. But I'm just thinking, because of that, there may have been, you know, they may have felt, well, we don't want to be mistaken for these communist Jews, so we need to speak up about our support for National Socialism.
Could be, yeah.
I mean, that may have played into it. In 1934, the VNJ's Dr. Max Neumann declared, we have placed the well-being of the German peoples and the fatherland, to which we feel inextricably linked, above our own well-being. That is why we welcomed the January 1933 national uprising, this in spite of the hardships it brought for us. But we saw in it the only means with which to overcome the damage wrought by un-German elements during those 14 tragic years. So he's even distancing himself from other Jews there. I guess mm-hmm. there were some blacks, weren't there, from the Rhineland?
Yeah, well, to me that was the start of race mixing in Europe, because, you know, 40,000 black soldiers were put into the Rhineland and armed to the teeth, took any women they wanted, because the German men weren't armed, and there were quite a lot of violence going down in that part of the of the country. I covered that in the Secret Masonic Victory.
I'm just thinking also, you know, we got the Weimar period and what happened then. There were a lot of, to use the terminology from here, foreign Jews that moved into Germany and bought up farms and bought up lots of real estate, and they were pimping the women out. And these were specifically Jews that flocked there from all over Europe. And this was one of the accusations made against them, wasn't it? You know, this cosmopolitan set that is at home nowhere and at home everywhere, that can just move between countries.
I mean, I believe that any country, you know, must put a certain block on anyone who's who's, you know, gone into the country, and so that they can't change the way of that particular country. And if you allow an element to kind of invade your culture, invade your structure, then suddenly, you know, the old country is changed from what it was. So to me, there should be laws in every country to stop certain immigrants from being in positions of political power, because the last thing you want is your country changing.
Well, it seems here that these German Jews were suffering as much as the German people were, and these foreign Jews that came in, they were the ones that caused a lot of the problems, because, I mean, that's what he's referring to here, damage wrought by un-German elements. So he's talking about people there that don't identify with Germany and are just there to take whatever they can from them, whereas he is identifying with Germany and with the Germans more than he's identifying with his own Jewish people. An Orthodox rabbi from Ansbach wrote in the same year, "I reject the teachings of Marxism from a Jewish viewpoint and profess National Socialism, naturally without its anti-Semitic components. Without this anti-Semitism, National Socialism would find its most devoted adherents amongst the Orthodox Jews." And that's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, the way that Israel is actually run is quite National Socialist, and they have their laws about not marrying non-Jews. And the state, Israel, is for the Jewish people, isn't it? It's an ethno-state.
Yeah, they didn't take any immigrants like Europe did.
Yeah, I mean, what he's saying here is, well, what he says here, the most devoted adherents of National Socialism would be Orthodox Jews if it didn't have the anti-Semitic components to it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, as stated earlier, these views were not that of the Jewish majority, but they were expressed in the media. An attitude, by the way, that the National Socialists did not appreciate. They did not want any support for their ideas from Jewish citizens. They wanted the Jews to disappear from Germany. So again, you've got another bit in here now. All this flattery that's actually coming from these Jews, and the Germans didn't really want to hear that flattery. They wanted the Jews to be proud of being Jews and not try to be Germans.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, that is the different, a totally different attitude to what they've had for the last 100 years, where they've been told, you know, you should be identifying with Germany, you should be becoming just like the Germans, you should be becoming assimilated. And now, you know, they're being told the opposite. But this opposite idea does coincide with the same ideas of the Zionists, who wanted the Jews to be Jews and be proud of being Jews and to have their own Jewish homeland. So the National Socialist attitude corresponded in principle to the Zionist position. They wished to establish a national Judaism, and thus they opposed any inner Jewish attachment to anything German. But they approved the National Socialism because they shared its basic tenet, devotion to one's own people and state. So this is the bit that they really had in common. In December 1935, George Koreski, the chairman of the German state Zionists, was interviewed on the Nuremberg Laws by Goebbels magazine Der Angriff. His views on how various questions arising from the legislation had been dealt with were quite positive. Koreski said that the Nuremberg Laws fulfilled old Jewish demands. For example, the separation of German and Jewish nationality, the establishment of schools for Jewish students only, nurturing and supporting a specific Jewish culture, and above all, the state prohibition of mixed marriages, which in any case Jewish law did not permit. The Koreski interview aroused controversy in Jewish circles, but Koreski received support from Orthodox Jews and even more so from Zionist groups. So again, we're told today these Nuremberg laws, they persecuted the Jews, and yet the Orthodox Jews were supportive of them because they were the same as the Jewish laws anyway. And they were also originally the church laws. The Christian church laws said that Christians couldn't marry with Jews and that Jews should live separately from Christians. And that's not a question of wanting to be mean to them. It's just the natural way to be, isn't it? Is to live among your own people. It's multiculturalism that seems to encourage conflict between these different groups. I mean, we've covered a lot.
And you've got to ask yourself who's behind that.
Well, we've talked a lot about how the National Socialist laws were reflecting the old church laws, haven't we, and the Catholic laws. Mm-hmm. And that was originally where they came from. And all of them, even that, you know, the wearing of special clothes to identify them, that was originally a church law.
I'm thinking more of the multiculturalism, as admitted, but Jews like Barbara Spector, who said the Jews are central to the policy of multiculturalism in Europe. And as she said, we'll be vilified for it.
Well, that comes down to another issue, doesn't it? That comes down to multiculturalism benefits the Jews when they're living among another nation. Because if you've just got the Jews and they are living amongst one people, like living amongst the Germans, it's going to be very easy to tell who the Jews are, and they're going to be this separate group. If you then have multiculturalism and you have lots of other races there, and especially if the other races look very different to the Germans, then when the Germans are looking at the Jews, they're going to look more like another German to them. They're not going to stand out so much. They're going to think, well, I'm closer to you, this Jew that looks like me, almost like me. I'm closer to him than I am to this person from Africa that looks completely different to me. So that's a basic instinctual drive that Jews will have when they're living in other nations to encourage other peoples to come and live there. Because it means they're safer.
Yeah, it's just that going to an old coffee colour, that's the problem.
Yeah, oh yeah, it's not of any benefit at all to us, but it is of benefit to them. So that's why, you know, I say you can't criticise them for doing that, because it is of benefit to them. It's not of benefit to us. And the people we should criticise is our politicians for going along with it, and our people for having the wool pulled over their eyes and believing that multiculturalism is of any benefit to us, because it's not. But it is of benefit to Jews, and we shouldn't expect them not to do it. And, you know, of course, they're not going to do it in their own country, are they? Because they're not living as a guest nation within a host nation. That's their own nation. They're not going to do it. But really, you know, you just look at ourselves and you think, well, how silly have we been to go along with it and to allow multiculturalism? But we can't expect them to not promote it. It's, you know, it's part of their strategy for survival.
It's a strategy for the one world government.
And what they would do is they'll promote the multiculturalism for the nation that they live among, whilst amongst their own people they promote the idea that they can only marry of their own kind, and that's why they have those laws. And also, I mean, if you're talking about Darwinian competition between these groups, the survival of the fittest, it benefits them to weaken the other groups while strengthening themselves. And that's another thing that most of our people just don't see going on, but that is what's going on. It's a competition between all the races for survival and for whichever group is the fittest. And a lot of these things that we aren't very happy about the Jews, because they encourage things that weaken us, it's all to their benefit.
Yeah, I can't really praise it though.
No. Well, you know, you can say they've been very successful at what they've done, and they've worked hard at it. But it hasn't really helped us out. But you shouldn't expect it to. We're the ones that are at fault for expecting it to. We should be advocating for our own people and doing what is best for our own people and teaching our people to resist things that are going to be harmful.
With respect, if they're going to bring in laws of, you know, no free speech, that's going to make it even difficult, sir.
It is. It does make it a lot more difficult, and you have to be very careful about what you say and about how the way that you put things. But that just makes it more of a challenge, doesn't it?
Well, it's more of a challenge, but you know, when I look back at the Russian Revolution and the Soviet Union, when they had anti-Semitism as a death sentence, then things, you know, can only get worse.
Yeah, well, it's a good point that you bring that up, because then you can say, well, at least we aren't that bad yet. We've got a little way to go yet before we get to where it's a death sentence for anti-Semitism. And I would say we shouldn't be thinking of things in terms of anti-Semitism anyway. We should be thinking in terms of being in competition with them, and they are our opponents, and we are competing against them in this struggle, this Darwinian struggle.
I agree with that. It's just that they're the ones who bring the anti-Semitism up. I don't think for a minute that this country's really racist, but it's been turned racist by what's happening to the country.
Well, that's another strategy of theirs, isn't it? See, this is another strategy that they've developed, is that they can make this accusation of anti-Semitism. And then if somebody is saying something that is identifying some of these strategies that they use that benefit them, it will silence that person.
That's exactly what it does, yeah.
And when you think, well, you know, they're a very, very small group, so they haven't got the strength of numbers because they're such a small group. That is the sort of thing you would expect them to develop, things like that, ways of using words and using the apparatus of the state to try and silence people, because they haven't got the force of an army to do it, because they're just this small group. So you would expect them to develop things like that, like the accusation of anti-Semitism, and to work very hard at getting that to be included in certain laws. And it
I agree, but they do have the finance. You know, they do have these, you know, like people like Soros who finance these groups.
I think it's very evenly balanced, actually, the competition. Like, as you say, they've got the finance, but they're a very small group. You know, we've got a larger group, but we've got more innovation and we've got more creativity. Then you can look at the blacks and you can say, well, they haven't really got the IQ, but they've got masses of numbers. You know, they've got billions of them. And it all seems balanced out to me. And, you know, we want a challenge. You want a good competition. You don't want the other races to be a pushover, do you?
But neither do you want, you know, by such a date, the whites to be a minority in their own country.
Well, of course not. That's what we're fighting against. That's why it's important that we discuss these issues, so that people understand the importance of standing up for your people. And that,
you know, I totally agree. But if they're starting the ways of standing up, then we're going to be in a minority quicker than we think.
Well, we have to work out ways that we can stay within the law and discuss these things. And it just sharpens us up, and it makes us better at what we do. And it makes us think about more about what we're doing and what we're saying and what the motives are, and breaking it all down into its constituent components. And, you know, I think it's all a positive thing. You don't want the competition to be a pushover. You don't want your opponents to be a pushover. You want them to be formidable opponents, so that when you defeat them, you have improved yourself massively in doing so. And
interesting enough, Michael Jones once came out and said that free speech couldn't be banned in America, and within weeks he was banned off YouTube. And you know, I have learned a lot from him since, and that's a country with a constitution which upholds free speech, or allegedly. So in a country which doesn't have such a constitution like ourselves, makes it even a huge task.
Well, it is a huge task. It's like a huge mountain. It's like looking at Mount Everest and people say, oh, we'll never be able to climb that, but we did. And somebody did, and they did beat it. And this is like that. It's you know, it's just another mountain for us to climb. It's another notch to put on our belt, you know, once we've achieved it. And you can look at it that, you know, Jews have been trying to achieve the influence that they have now. They've spent 2,000 years working very, very hard at it, and they devoted themselves to it, and their religious books are full of it, and they've taught all their children it. And it's only in the last century that they've actually managed to achieve this. And you have to give them credit for tenacity and working so hard at it for so long. And really, you have to look at ourselves and say, well, look, you know, there must be something wrong with white people to have allowed this to happen. We've suddenly become weak. And why is it that we've become weak? We've become weak
because two world wars.
Yeah, and we've started. Why do we have these wars? Because we started ignoring our traditions. We ignored what our ancestors told us. If we had sticked with what our ancestors told us, then Jews would never have been in a position to gain the influence that they have now, because we wouldn't have made that edict of 1812 where they were emancipated. We would have kept them separate from us and said, well, you do your separate thing, we'll do our separate thing. But we didn't. We ignored the traditions and thought, well, we know better now. We're all humans. We'll give each other human rights and we'll all have the same rights. But that doesn't work when you've got different species, different races in this competition. We're going a little bit over time here, Dennis, and we've gone a little bit off subject, but that's fine.
With you, yeah.
We can continue this next week, I think. So thank you very much for coming on today.
Okay.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend.